Prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob.
Ladies, gentlemen, trees and multiforms. No, this is not Aaron who is opening the show. This is Ethan who is opening the show. Obviously, I'm Ethan, and I'm here with my co-host, Aaron.
Hello, hello.
I see that there's that, you know, there's a little delay there each time, so, you know, we have to deal with that. But we are actually being joined today by new blood, someone new who's new to the show who we haven't actually had on before. We're joined by the gentleman that I will always consider to be Charlie Brown, because that was the first time I saw him. That's what he looked like. It's Mr. Cape Rust.
Hello.
All right, Cape, who are you and why do you want to talk about, well, in this case tonight, Die Hard?
Well, my name is Cape Rust, born and raised in Texas. You can hold that against me if you want to. I was in the Army for about 12 years, was a geek my entire life. I write for the website Pop Cults as well as Role Players Chronicle, and do some book reviews for Cobalt Quarterly and cover, you know, wonderful conventions like CantCon. And I really want to talk about Die Hard because I think that in a way – John McClane is kind of America's cooler James Bond.
Yeah, I think it certainly at a level, especially with the latest release with Die Hard 5, A Good Day to Die Hard. John McClane now joins the ranks of Dirty Harry with having 5 movies to his name. So I think what we had was Dirty Harry and then passing on the torch to another cop, another rogue cop out there, John McClane. We don't really have any geekly happenings to go over today. We were just talking about that. It's been sort of a slow news week and nothing much we really want to talk about. So I think, unless there are any objections, we'll jump right on into talking about some Die Hard awesomeness.
Okay.
All right. Well, Die Hard. Die Hard came out in 1988, so I got to ask you guys, have any of you read the novel that Die Hard is based on?
There's a novel?
There's a novel. It's a novel called Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe. It was published in 1979, and is actually a sequel novel to a novel that Roderick Thorpe wrote called The Detective, which was actually a movie starring Frank Sinatra. And actually the character in the book in Nothing Lasts Forever is named Joseph Leland and is a much older sort of a retired police officer or a police officer that's been
put to pasture.
Put to pasture type of thing. And I have read the novel and it was an absolutely, to be quite honest, terrible book. It was all of what is sort of we know as became Die Hard is in the book, but the main character is older and he's there visiting his daughter, and it's some big oil company that I think it's Claxon Oil Corporation, and it's there on Christmas Eve. It's all that these German terrorists show up led by a guy named Anton Gruber. Who is, I believe, called, I was just reading it today, but Little Tony the Red is his nickname. And Sergeant Al Powell's in it. His daughter's name is Stephanie Gennaro. So, I mean, it's got a lot of the elements in there that we would know to become what we know as Die Hard. What I found interesting is when they first optioned the book, they actually were required to ask, this was in 1980, you know, 1986, 87, when they were developing and starting to film the movie. They actually had to go talk to Frank Sinatra to see if he wanted to be in the movie, to be John McClane, because he did the original movie, The Detective. And I guess at that point it would have been Joe Leland. Thankfully, he said no. we love the chairman, but what we know to be Die Hard now sort of evolved from honestly, you know, Bruce Willis. So really, let me ask you guys this, Aaron. When was the first time you saw Die Hard?
I saw Die Hard for the first time in the theater when it came out. So what was that, 1988. So I was like 8 years old. And I saw it because my parents were both fans of Moonlighting. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to see what was up with, David Adamson, see what it's like when he's a cop. And it was, you know, they were kind of, they're kind of taken aback by what they're seeing because, you know, it's pretty violent by today's standards for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was very violent by 1988 standards. And they're like, oh, my God, what did we just watch? I walked out thinking that, wow, that was pretty cool. It was awesome when he ran over the broken glass. But, you know, I think the first Die Hard and the first thing that pops to my mind is the villain. It's Hans Gruber, Alan Rickman. I mean, it's one of the best performances I've seen in a long time.
And this was his first, like, American movie, his introduction.
Yeah.
Other than, I guess, now he's known as Snape. But I think for the longest time, this is pretty much what I really associated Alan Rickman with was, oh, yeah, he's the bad guy from Die Hard.
Yeah, that and the Sheriff of Nottingham.
That too.
which was actually a very interesting role, almost a lot more comical than you think it was going to be, but it kind of worked.
Oh, yes, yes. That's a much underrated, I think, movie. But when he came in as Hans Gruber in Die Hard, you just gotta think this is one of those situations. It's the Citizen Kane situation where you go back, you watch Citizen Kane now, and pretty much all of the tropes in that movie, all of the technical achievements in that movie are all common nowadays. So you're not as wowed by it. But understanding that when it was made, all of that was amazing. Die Hard sort of created its own genre, where it's so six parts John McClane, then four parts the bad guy. Real quick though, Cape, when was the first time you saw Die Hard, and what did you feel about it?
Well, I saw it in the theater as well. I want to say that I was just starting high school, and what I remember is one seeing it in THX, you know, which was you know, the thing. And I do remember seeing it in the main theater. And my impression of it was because, you know, that was kind of, I don't want to call it the cheesy golden age of action movies, mm-hmm. but you know, your Schwarzeneggers, your Stallones, your, you know, so many of those guys were kind of at their, you know, their pinnacle with their one-liners, you know, the one-liner kind of action hero. And I just remember seeing this and thinking, for some reason, Bruce Willis, I don't want to say that he did it better, but he kind of Sinatra'd it and did it his way. Mm-hmm. And the one-liners that Willis pulled off, and, you know, pulling them off in a very typical Bruce Willis manner, just seemed more, less forced. With Bruce Willis really bringing that, his kind of unique flavor to the, you know, the action hero one-liner. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing that really kind of blew me away was the special effects. And of course, now at the time, as you look back on Die Hard, you're like, wow, that's some serious green screen there. Mm-hmm. But at the time, just had no concept of, you know, how they pulled that off. And that was one of those things that just really stuck with me. I mean, great explosions, great gunfights, and really kind of over-the-top action in the best possible way.
Yeah. Well, Die Hard definitely came in, and I think, like I said, it sort of created its own genre of movie. And from basically after Die Hard, people would start, people, even Hollywood types, all those, would start quantifying other movies as, oh, it's Die Hard on a plane, or it's Die Hard on a train with snakes or something. And et cetera, et cetera. And when this came out in 98 or in 88, this was just not something people really were expecting. You know, I mean, they were getting movies like Commando and Cobra and stuff like that. And they really weren't getting this character in there. I think one of the coolest things and best things about John McClane that is really established in this first movie is that he's not invincible, you know? And I remember, Aaron, you talked briefly about you said something about that scene with him with the broken glass, you know. And
that was just a great scene, wasn't it?
You can't imagine seeing a scene like that with, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger or Jean-Claude Van Damme or anything. But with John McClane, with Bruce Willis, you expect it, you know. And I think that's part of what makes these movies work is that he doesn't seem invincible because, man, he gets the crap beat out of him in these movies.
Yes, he does.
and you know, that's sort of a shtick of John McClane, is he gets the crap beat out of him in these movies.
And he gets dirty. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
I mean, by the end of Die Hard, you know, Die Hard, his wife beater is like coyote, like desert coyote color.
Yes. And I find myself, after seeing that movie numerous times, you watch it and you go, that thing has got to smell so awful by the end of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
That he couldn't sneak up on terrace anymore because people are like, did you kill a cat? I mean,
the American smells like dirty German and Austrian cigarettes, cat urine, and just a hint of, well, I don't know, but it's very American.
Yes. Well,
Ethan, what about the first time you saw this?
The first time I saw it?
I mean,
Well, first time I saw Die Hard, I was with my dad, and I believe we were watching it. I think he picked up the Laserdisc, so this was back in Laserdisc time. And
wow!
And this was a, it's. I'd probably seen bits and pieces of it here, but my first very clear recollection of seeing Die Hard was watching with my dad on our big screen TV that we had, and thinking that as we were going through it, going, well, yeah, I've seen all these, you know, Die Hard on a blank and Die Hard on a blank, et cetera, et cetera. But this is fun to see where it all sort of started, and, you know, see a Bruce Willis with hair. Mm-hmm. But really, the thing that impacted me the most in this movie was something that not a lot of movies do even today, is that all the villains, even the little villains, the mooks that don't have a name, you know, had something that made them feel more real. Like the John Long, I think that's the guy's name, the Chinese guy who's the mook and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. They're getting set up and they're getting ready for the police to assault the tower, and he sets up behind this candy counter. And there's that bit where he sits there for a second, and then he reaches in and pulls out a candy bar and starts to eat it. And it's little things like that that they did in this movie that really endeared it to me, because I'm like, now it feels like these people are a lot more real. And you know, when they die, it's like, well, yeah, they're bad guys. I expect them to die. Or that scene where Carl comes down and chainsaws through all those wires just to before his brother is ready for him, and his brother's all pissed off. It's stuff like that you don't see even a lot of times nowadays, you know?
Well, and that you know, it's funny that you say that, because that scene right there established him as a hothead.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't take but, what, 5 seconds of screen time?
Yeah. And it's that great storytelling of showing you rather than telling you type of thing, because they could just tell you, well, that's Carl, he's a hothead, you know, but they didn't have to do that. But really, you can't talk Die Hard without really pushing Hans Gruber and Alan Rickman. I mean,
yeah, such a great character.
Easily with the Die Hard movies, I think, yes, you got this great character in John McClane, but you also equally have these great characters in the main villain. I mean, the main villain is almost always is almost Hitchcockian type of villain. So the villain comes in and they're smart, they're charismatic. You completely understand why people are following them. You know, it's like, well, no, it's this. I'm not just some guy who growls and chews on scenery. It's like, no, it's, you know, Hans Gruber walks in and says, you know, makes his presence known and starts eating a sandwich because he's wearing a great Armani suit.
yes, he is. But I would also like to add into that it's kind of the trifecta, though, because one of the other things that makes these movies so great is all the ancillary characters, mm-hmm. Al Powell, you know, the reporters, you know, there's, you know, his wife, You know, the cocaine sniffing businessman not just Ellis. With the villains. Yes, yeah. You know, Ellis, what in the hell are you doing? But all Bond, of those characters, Ruby. Yeah, they all came to life as well in that same manner that they did with the other characters. And I just think that was something that we kind of overlook sometimes because they aren't stars.
Yeah. Well, and definitely the ancillary characters all felt really fleshed out. They felt real in this movie. Because really, I mean, watching this movie, you feel like you're getting a glimpse of this day in the life of this guy, and that there are all these people, they don't feel like they're characters written in a script as far as, okay, well, we need a SWAT team, a bunch of SWAT team guards to run in here. It's like, well, no, there's the SWAT team, there's this guy who, you know, runs through the bushes and then goes, ow, when he, comes upon the thorns and stuff like that. And little things like that really just made this movie feel so much deeper, you know? And you had this, it just created a really cool sense of connection to it. And the building itself being, I think one of Fox's, it's on the Fox lot, 20th Century Fox lot. I forget the name of the building, but they use it as offices.
Nakatomi Tower.
Yeah, it's Nakatomi Tower, but it's a real building and it's on the Fox lot. Yeah. They just built it. And, you know, then they, you know, what more can you really say about, I mean, the awesomeness of this, the awesomeness and the depth of this movie, you know,
and the building itself kind of became a character.
Yeah,
and it had its distinct zones, if you will. And the other thing that I kind of liked about it, and I don't know if this was something they were trying to do, but you know, as you talk about the book being written in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
Did you ever kind of get a little bit of a Towering Inferno?
Yeah,
vibe.
Towering Inferno, Roderick Thorpe, the writer of the novel, said that Towering Inferno was one of the inspirations for it,
Okay,
the book.
Well, then I got it.
Yeah. But with Die Hard, now, Aaron, I know Alan Rickman is you're a huge Alan Rickman fan. And, you know...
Oh, absolutely.
Hans Gruber pretty much set the standard for the Euro trash villain, you know, from this point on.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, because I think of all of the Die Hard real knockoff movies, you know, like Passenger 57, you had a Euro trash villain, you know? And other movies like that, as you progress on into the deeper into the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, is you had these Alan Rickman knockoffs. What was it about Hans? I mean, I know you're a huge fan of his. What did you love about Hans?
Well, I mean, I think he kind of nailed it there with the Eurotrash villain, because you know it's become, I mean, it's become cliched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anymore you just have, you know, this fill in the blank and you forget about the guy, you know, after the movie's on. Or, you know, his name is effectively frickin' bad guy in the movie.
Right.
But with Alan Rickman and Hans Gruber, he really did create a compelling character, you know, because, you know, he's obviously ruthless with the way that he just flat out executed Ellis trying to get the detonators back from John McClane.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he also had those really human moments that, you know, showed he had a sense of humor, that he's smart, like, you know, I do love the part with, you know, oh, yes, I have an Armani as well, and, you know, all that stuff. But I also really liked the part when he was off looking for the detonators, and he runs into John McClane, and just, you know, just on a whim, he just starts talking in an American accent and starts pretending like he's one of the hostages.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was just the fact that, you know, he wasn't just like a cardboard cutout, you know, cookie cutter villain. You know, he did actually bring something to this character beyond, you know, this is the, you know, the flesh bag holding the gun, shooting it at the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, there's just, he's just a great character. And Alan Rickman just has a screen presence that, you know, can't be duplicated. I mean, he's incredible. And I think this is, you know, I mean, it almost feels, you know, awful to say, but it's one of the best performances he's ever turned in. And you know, I mean, I still think about him 20 years, well, longer than 20 years later. So yeah, just an all-around great villain.
Me too.
And I know you picked him for your number six favorite movie villains list, if I remember correctly.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
You know, back in the day.
That sounds about right. Cape, what strikes you as far as Hans Gruber from Die Hard?
Well, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting is if you look at the timeline of the movie, that we still had a little bit of the Cold War, you know, kind of feelings. And, you know, they didn't make him a Russian. They made him kind of an Austro-German, kind of a, you know, you kind of say Eurotrash, but I almost call him more of your European Union villain. What I loved was the efficiency. I was stationed in Germany for, you know, 3.5 years. And, you know, we joke about the German efficiency, but he really had so many things planned. And, you know, his ability to just to execute them was phenomenal. And, of course, like, you know, everybody loves kind of that cold-blooded villain who could pull the trigger when none of us could.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because, you know, he gives that bio on Nakatomi. You know, he studied his foe, mm-hmm. you know, very kind of Sun Tzu kind of a feel. But for even for me, you know, I was a soldier for 12 years, and knowing that much about somebody that I'm, you know, that I'm holding a gun to their head, it makes it a lot more difficult to, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, to execute him. I mean, because that's what it was. It was, you know, a complete execution. And he didn't bat an eye,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, and so I really kind of respect that highly intelligent yet efficiently cold-blooded nature that he had. And as much as I didn't like him, I loved him.
Mm-hmm. You love to hate him.
Oh, yeah. You love to hate him. Yeah. Yeah, that's the sign of a good villain.
And at the end, when everything was going to pot, he was still – you know, he didn't sit there and say, "Oh, I'm the mastermind." He was ready to get his hands dirty.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't just stop and say, "Oh, well, it's not working out the way I wanted to." He was ready to get in there and, you know, make sure that McClane didn't get out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was no question that he was the guy who was in charge. You know, and
yeah,
I keep going back to the Hitchcockian thing. It's that charisma, and you know, Hitchcock believed that if you had a villain, people would have to want to follow him, and you could entirely see why people would want to follow Hans, because he had real presence, you know, and he had that he had a plan, he executed it. And that sort of brings us to another sort of trope of the Die Hard movies, is that what the villains are seemingly there for really isn't what they're there for, you know. And in Die Hard, right, they take these hostages, and you know, but they're really there not as terrorists but as thieves. They're stealing what, $600 million in negotiable bearer bonds.
Bearer bonds.
Yeah, he read about it. Yeah, he read about the crisis situation in Newsweek.
Yeah.
And that is an ongoing thing. I mean, there is that double cross with, you know, all the villains in all the movies mm-hmm. so far.
Well, and you know, you look at the Bond movies. You know, mm-hmm. there's a formula. And you know, sometimes we get really upset with the whole formula because we think, oh, you know, it's lazy or whatever. But, you know, Bond movies work because they follow their formula.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and I think that the Die Hard movies do the same thing, but it's the way that they do it.
Correct. Yes, it's the execution, you know. It's we know where it's heading. We know that each movie is going to end with you know, Bruce Willis or John McClane all beat to hell, but he's going to win. But
yeah.
I mean, honestly, there are times though in the movies where you're not sure if you know he could have the utter crap beat out of him. You don't know. Okay, he could lose a leg in this movie. We don't know because
yeah.
because yeah, he just
true.
Has the crap beat out of him. That's a huge thing. Is one of the reasons I really love the Die Hard movies, the Die Hard franchise, is because he's not a superhero. He's not invincible, and he just seems to be this guy that is doing his job and ends up in these situations and is like, well, no one else is going to deal with it. I guess I've got to. And
definitely.
He gets, and I mean, and as the movies progress, I mean, his personal life is pretty crappy.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, when you talk about him kind of being forced in that situation to be the guy that does something, if you look at the first movie, when he watches Nakatomi get executed, he's like, why didn't you do something, John? Why didn't you do something? You know, and he goes through that kind of that moral conundrum. And even when he's got the gun, what was the, I think it was Carl, to Carl's head.
Mm-hmm.
The first terrorist that he takes out, the guy says, you know, you can't shoot me, I'm a policeman. And it's almost like, or you can't shoot me because you're a policeman. And it's almost like you can see just a bit of hesitation in Bruce Willis's eyes, because he's like, yeah, I am a policeman. And then he's like, never mind.
Right. Yeah. And I'll point out, you know, it's like one establishing fact of that, him not being Arnold Schwarzenegger, not being Sylvester Stallone, not being whoever, is, you know, his first reaction to the terrorist showing up is he calls the police. You know?
Yeah.
Yep.
He tries to get help because, you know, he's like, well, this sucks, and there's a bunch of armed dudes here, and I'm going to call the cops.
Well, and welcome to the party, pal.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that is a tenet of police work. You know, mm-hmm. I worked in the military prison for a year, and you never confronted an inmate alone. You know, you call backup.
Right.
And like, you know, you pointing that out, that is such a natural reaction because you always want to have those numbers on your side.
All right. Well, let's progress the dial here to, 2 years later. It was only 2 years later. They did Die Hard 2, mm-hmm. Die Harder.
The ongoing thing with our show, but yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Every title.
First of all, that's just a great subtitle for the movie. I mean, come on, Die Hard.
Yeah, it really is.
And of course, you know, added the speculation, Die Hard 3 would be Die Hardest, and Die Hard 4 would be Die Harder or something.
Harder.
You know, Die Hard 2 comes out, and it's not directed by McTiernan, it's directed by Rennie Harlan. What had he done up to that? I mean, I know he went on to do other things, but I don't think he had done.
I'm not familiar with the chronology of his filmography, but yeah, I mean, he's a guy that's, you know, he's kind of got a bad reputation, especially now, because he directed the Cutthroat Island, the mm-hmm. biggest box office bomb of all time.
Right.
You know, but he also did like The Long Kiss Goodnight and some other good movies.
As I understand it, Rennie Harlan left directing duties on Alien 3 to come do this movie.
Oh yeah,
that's a good call.
Yes, that would have been a good call. but I mean, this movie is probably, I think, you know, we've talked about sort of the quintessential early 90s sequel binge that they went on. This is definitely one of them, because it takes place a year after the first movie on Christmas Eve, and this time he's at the airport. And apparently this one was also based on a novel called 58 Minutes by mm-hmm. Walter Wager, which I've never read. On it, but apparently it was served as the basis for this one, and this one had a brief appearance by Al Powell, showing back up briefly, but
eating Twinkies,
right?
Eating Twinkies.
And the thing I remember a lot from this movie is sort of looking at it, because I went back and watched it obviously years after it came out, is that there were lots of familiar faces in the movie. I mean, there, as far as people I'd seen crop up in other ones, like Fred Thompson was in there, Dennis Franz, I remember one of the bad guys' henchmen is Robert Patrick,
yep.
who went mm-hmm. on to be the Terminator, the T-1000, you know. You know, this one obviously, you know, people can gripe about it all they want, and it never really measured up quite to the first movie. This one definitely just sort of took that whole took the whole, you know, John McClane thing to the to the extreme of even he says it in the movie, if I remember right, he's like, how could the same shit happen to the same guy twice, you know? Because here he is on the opposite side of the country a year later, and there are terrorists again. I for one, am glad that they didn't continue that trend for the next three movies.
Yeah.
Because it would have been kind of silly after a while. But this one was definitely a formulaic sequel, and the villain in it was, you said his name earlier.
William Atherton.
William Atherton, yes.
Isn't that a great name, Atherton?
I know.
Oh, it really is.
Yeah. And actually, I was watching it, and one of the other small roles that I thought was funny is the engineering officer from The Next Generation was actually in the cockpit of one of the aircraft.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I forget what his name is, but he was there. But he was also in it, and it's just funny when you see, you know, going from this to Star Trek The Next Generation is definitely a, you know, kind of a jump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when I first saw the second one, you mean, you obviously compare it up to the first one, and it has a lot of, it lacks quite a bit as far as not having Alan Rickman in there. But you do have, I think what was fun about this one was the that it was instead of a foreign threat, it was this sort of domestic terrorist cell type of thing, or because if memory serves right, he was the bad guy was a colonel in the army or like ex-military or something like that.
Yeah,
special forces at least special operations unit.
And you first see him naked. That's right. The first time they introduce him, he's completely naked in his hotel room.
Doing his katas.
Yes. And that's if you're not familiar with William Atherton from anything else, you know, I mean, pretty much watch a Frank Darabont movie and you'll see him. It's kind of odd to think of him as this horrible or this completely ripped up, you know, ripped, you know, peak physical specimen type of bad guy. I also remember him as Death in the second,
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Hey, you know, work is work, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, you gotta pay bills, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I kind of liked that one.
But like,
hey, I will unashamedly admit that I am a fan of Bill and Ted.
Oh yeah. No problems with Bill and Ted here. I like the first one. The second one was okay. The first one was great.
Yes.
I like the second one, Station. Yeah, those are movies from my childhood that I was a fan of. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you guys think of? How did Die Hard 2 sort of shape up as far as sequels and sort of continuing the franchise?
Well, for me, this one's kind of got a strange history with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys had one of those movies that your parents saw before you got a chance to see, and something in it just offended them, and they're like, you can't see that, it's really violent or whatever. And this is one of those movies for me to where my parents, I guess, saw it before me, and they said, you know, you can't watch that because the guy got stabbed in the eye with an icicle. Mm-hmm. It's too violent. Like, what? Okay. And then, you know, I eventually saw it. I probably saw it like the second they told me not to, knowing me. But, you know, I eventually saw it, and, you know, there was too much of that, you know, I'm getting too old for this shit. More, ha ha ha, wink at the camera thing going on here. You know, because you had Sergeant Al Powell, because you had Bonnie Bedelia, I mean, the frickin' the scumbag reporter guy just happened to be on the plane, and you know it did kind of have that, you know, tired element to it, that like, oh come on. But at the same time, you know, it's an action flick, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's you know, I'm not looking for Shakespeare, I'm just looking to be entertained. And I thought, you know, obviously it's a tough act to follow Alan Rickman, but I thought Atherton did a pretty good job, and you know, there's some good action beats in it overall. I mean, it's okay.
William Atherton was Thorne, was the reporter, the bad guy's William Sadler.
Yeah, Sadler. Excuse me. Sadler. Yeah, Atherton was the reporter.
My bad.
Excuse me. Yeah, William Sadler.
And Atherton made a career out of playing you know, unlikable characters, you know, in Ghostbusters.
No, he's essentially playing the same character in Ghostbusters as he, you know, except as a reporter. He did a good job of playing a jackass.
Well, and, you know, I really did like him as the professor in Real Genius.
Oh, that, yep, he was a jackass in that, too.
Well, and kind of a funny thing, I don't know if you know this, but the guy who played Laszlo in Real Genius, that was Uncle Rico in Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah,
and he was also the father in Stick It, which, if you haven't seen, we can discuss that some other time. But, yeah, he was, and he's, again, he's one of those ancillary characters that you just can't stand the guy.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it was what it was, and it was a good placeholder. It's probably low on my list of the overall Die Hard movies, but sure. Yeah.
It was probably my least favorite until recently.
Yeah, I would say that too. Me too.
Why until recently?
Well, because we saw. Because I saw Good Day to Die Hard.
Good Day to Die Hard. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the things, because I've rewatched it recently too. One of the parts that really struck me, because you know you talk about kind of the human element of John McClane, was his when he's trying to get the British Airways flight to wave off, and he's on the tarmac and it crashes. He's crying, like the guy's crying, and then he walks up and picks up this burnt doll, you know, and okay, granted, it's, you know, it's kind of overplayed or whatever, but and then right afterwards, I mean, he's sitting there sulking, you know, it's not like he just bounces back and is like, okay, you know, we're gonna, you know, get everything figured out. I mean, the guy looks traumatized, or as traumatized as, you know, you can be in an action movie like this, but that kind of was nice to see that they kept that human side of McClane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Willis manages to do that with the character very well, keeping him so human. And I do remember that scene. And to say that it was one of my least favorite movies, this is I still like this movie actually. It's still of the it's very much a early 90s sequel. It feels like it's a studio sequel saying, well, the first one did great, so let's do another one. But this is actually much more of a well put together, a better put together sequel than I'd say the fifth one that just came out. This one still feels like Die Hard.
Well, and you have to give him credit because even though, you know, the whole Bonnie Bedelia thing and, you know, Atherton, you know, but the way that they did it, I mean, you have to kind of give him some credit for at least sort of trying to be creative, putting him on the plane. You know, yeah, you really need to have him in there? Probably not. But I do have to kind of give him some credit for at least – trying to give some kind of plausible explanation for their presence as opposed to just stuffing them in there and insulting us.
Yeah. And, you know, this movie is still a lot of fun. I mean, it is an early 90s action movie, but it's still a good one. And comparatively speaking to a lot of other movies that came out at the time, like I was saying, it still feels like a Die Hard movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much.
Because you got the villain in there, and William Sadler is a good villain. He's not Hans Gruber by any means, but he's not supposed to be. He's a very, very different character, and he's still a very interesting character, and was actually a good villain. And you really did feel like he had he could more than match John McClane, you know, in one-on-one type of thing.
And he definitely, you know, like you said, the trope of not being the villains that you think they are, their master plan, you know, was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, is there anything else about the second one that we want to touch on before we move on with a vengeance?
You know, it is what it is. I wouldn't say don't watch it, but I just think overall it's, you know, it's a weaker installment. But, you know, every installment has to have its weakest parts. And one of the weaker ones here is a good one. So, no, I'm ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Excellent. Well, 5 years went by without a Die Hard movie. And then McTiernan took up directing again with the third movie, with Die Hard with a Vengeance. I remember when this movie came out, it was a huge deal. Like, it's back when Entertainment Tonight actually, you know, reported on Entertainment. They actually talked about this movie coming out. And this movie, of course, has a direct tie-in to the first movie with Jeremy Irons coming in as a villain. I mean, and that's, we're talking, great people to have play villains in here, and people coming in who's like, yeah, I want to see this guy as a bad guy, you know. Jeremy Irons. Okay, oof. I'm there.
Hell yeah.
And he's playing Simon Gruber, like, you know, and he comes in with this, you know, yeah, it's a little contrived, it's a little cheesetastic, but who cares? You know, he comes in and basically holds this whole city hostage with his mad bombing, but he has another agenda going on, but he also wants to really screw over John McClane because, well, John did kind of throw – the Irish Flatfoot did throw his brother off a building. And I really enjoy this movie, and it does sort of get borderline on the whole buddy cop type of a formula with Samuel L. Jackson in there being the racist melon farmer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
and this was actually the first Die Hard movie that was not based on a novel of any kind. This was, I remember reading when this came out that this the original script by Jonathan Hensley went through several iterations, and at one point it was actually going to be a Lethal Weapon movie.
Thank God it wasn't.
Yeah, instead they went this direction and got Samuel Jackson and Bruce Willis involved and made it Die Hard with a Vengeance. And I remember when this movie's coming out, we were all stoked for it because at this point, you know, we're old enough to go see this stuff in theaters, and I'm just like, yeah, finally a new Die Hard movie, you know? And it looked really good too. What strikes you from this movie that's really, you know, really brings out the whole Die Hard aspect of it?
Now me, for example, I love Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think it is fantastic. I think that, you know, obviously the first one's important because, you know, like, you know, where it brought us and it did certain things to the action genre in the early late 80s, early 90s and stuff like that. But I think I would rather watch Die Hard with a Vengeance than I would want to watch, you know, the original Die Hard. But, you know, it's just, you know, it's the overall thing. I mean, it's a really good thrilling movie. It's got a lot of character development, a lot of story angles, a lot of character threads to follow through for an action movie. I mean, you have everything with Zeus, Samuel L. Jackson's character in it, you know, being a bitter racist black man and, you know, blaming everything on, you know, the white man. And you have everything going on with John McClane, and, you know, he's separated from his wife, and, you know, he's one step from being an alcoholic, and he's, you know, doing the whole thing on a hangover. And then you have everything going on with you know, Peter Gruber, with, you know, Simon. You know, Simon says you have that really thrilling element where they're, you know, put on the wild goose chase where they have to go all over the city and, you know, way out the water, and they do all their little mind games and stuff like that. And, you know, again, there's lots of really good action beats, and I do think that, you know, in the end, everything comes together really well, and you have a good, satisfying ending. I think this is a very excellent movie. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Well, and for me, one of the things that struck me, and one of the things that's also struck me, is the scope. The scope of this movie was so much more grandiose than, you know, being confined to an airport or to a building. Mm-hmm. And when you have that whole city to play with, you know, you get kind of that Grand Theft Auto sandbox feel to it. And
well, and the first two movies had a real sense of claustrophobia about them.
Yeah,
definitely. And the other thing that is striking me as we're having this this conversation, and without trying to get, you know, too deep into it, but we are talking about movies, is the Die Hard franchise has always been very good about having a strong Black or African American lead, depending on how you want to phrase that. And even in the second movie with the guy working up in the air, the air traffic controller, and Samuel L. Jackson, and not that that's a huge deal, but at the same time, even your villains, even amongst the Euro trash, one of the smartest guys technically, is the African American. And I just find that interesting because, I'm not really looking at the racial situation at the time, but there's always complaints about there aren't enough strong, characters of color, minorities or whatever. And yet the Die Hard franchise was doing it, and they were doing it without trying to make a statement about it.
Yeah. Right. They're just getting the right people for the right roles.
Exactly. And one of the other things that struck me as interesting was Samuel L. Jackson's name, Zeus. Historically, obviously Zeus, in Greek mythology is an important figure, but historically a lot of African Americans had mythological names, Apollo, Zeus, things like that, especially in the times of slavery. And I wonder if that was a very subtle kind of, his whole hatred of the white man, kind of a play onto that, and it kind of played into it. But ultimately, he was a great buddy for the buddy film.
Well, and as I understand it, what I read about it and what I've seen about in extra features here and there is that originally that character was supposed to be sort of this Asian character. And then they were talking about casting, and someone brought up Samuel Jackson, and they just were like, "Yeah, let's do it."
Yeah.
And thank goodness, right? I mean, definitely. I see what you're saying, though. I never really thought about that, because in the first movie, you've got you've even got two very strong African American characters in there with Anton. The limo driver, and of course Al Powell, and in the second movie, it's the air traffic controller guy, and in this one it's obviously Sam Jackson. To an extent, in the third movie, there's the sort of strong character of the FBI, or I think he's the FBI agent that's heading up the division. Yeah. And he's not really African American, but he's Arabic, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now the fifth movie is missing all that entirely, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
This one really went back to oddly, it had another one that had an Englishman playing a German guy with Jeremy Irons, and really Jeremy Irons and Sam Jackson are the two things I really remember well from this movie, and I love this movie. It's a great movie.
Oh yeah.
I really like how they had this whole double cross thing going on, and it was a double cross. There were like two double crosses even, because
triple blind.
Simon is supposed to be stealing this gold, and then destroying it, and he's like, screw that, I'm gonna keep it, and in true Gruber fashion.
Family tradition.
Exactly. I know, like brothers,
You mentioned it, but it worked so well. I mean, I would never have thought of Jeremy Irons, but it worked so well. I don't know if I was just, I've been brainwashed to believe it, but I really could believe it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Jeremy Irons is an excellent actor. This was like, I'm not going to say fresh, but this is one of the first things I remember seeing him in after he did Lion King. And it was kind of a fun transition there. But, obviously that was like 5-6 years later. But I do remember that, and I'm all like, cool, I like him. And, he's an Oscar-winning actor. He's a good actor, and he plays villains very well. And this is like one of those, arrows in his quiver for his career. And, this is one of those ones I always think of. I did like him quite a bit.
And apparently, in reading sort of about it, apparently there is an alternate ending of the movie where the were actually, and it's apparently on the special edition DVD. I wonder if it's on the new Die Hard Blu-ray set. And the alternate ending of it, the robbery succeeds, and McClane is used as a scapegoat for everything that's gone wrong, and is fired from the New York NYPD. And the FBI has taken away his pension. He tracks Simon down using the batch number on a bottle of aspirins, and they meet at a cafe in Hungary.
Okay.
Holy shit.
Yeah. In this version, apparently Simon had double-crossed most of his accomplices, gotten the loot to a safe hiding place in Nova Scotia, and has the gold turned into statuettes of the Empire State Building.
wow.
Okay.
Bond villain. Yeah.
Hey, just curious. Were they in Budapest in Hungary, or did they really say?
They didn't say. It just says Hungary.
Okay, because the only reason I ask is I was actually in Hungary for about 9 months deployed, so I can kind of see Gruber going to Hungary, to do some of his nefarious stuff.
And apparently McClane was supposed to invite Simon to play a game of McClane Says, involving a form of Russian roulette with a small Chinese rocket launcher.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yeah, I'm kind of glad that was an alternate ending.
It'd be cool to see, though. I mean, that's a totally different direction than what happened.
Yeah, that's interesting. Apparently, huh? According to the screenwriter, they decided to ditch this because the studio thought it was it showed a more cruel and menacing side to McClane.
You think?
So apparently a second alternate ending had McClane and Carver floating back to shore in a makeshift raft after the explosion at sea, where Carver said it's a shame that the bad guys are going to get away. McClane tells him not to be so sure. The scene then shifts to a plane where the terrorists find the briefcase bomb they left in the park and which Carver gave back to them. And then it explodes.
Okay.
See, that I kind of like, a little bit of...
And the film would have ended like darkly seven. Comic note as Simon asked anyone if they had a 4-gallon jug.
Yeah, I can get behind that.
Yes, and, I mean, I remember this one came out, and I really enjoyed this one, but this one gets kind of a crappy... doesn't get sort of a lot of love that it should, I think.
I don't get that. I did like this one a lot.
It's a good movie. It's a good one. Well, then, 12 years went by before we got another one. We got Live Free or Die Hard, Die Hard 4.0, released as Die Hard 4.0 outside of North America. And this one was directed by Len Wiseman. And this movie, I thought, was hysterical. the only part of this movie that sort of almost loses me is sort of John McClane, hanging onto the side of the, running around on an airplane, wing, had a bit.
Oh, I thought that was cool.
That was cool, but that sort of got him into sort of superhero territory. But it was, this one was good. I really enjoyed, The Timothy Oliphant in it was a lot of fun. Yeah. He's a good, strong villain. And this one, of course, sort of upped the ante, whereas in the first movie you had him in a building, the second one in an airport, third one in a city, and this fourth one is the country, you know? And this one obviously is much more fresh in our minds because it only came out about, 5 or 6 years ago. And this one had, I think the biggest thing about this one, though, was it came out and was PG-13, which was...
Yeah, that was a bad move. It was such a bad move.
Why do you say that?
Why do I say that?
Yeah.
Because I think of Live Free or Die Hard, and I've seen the movie. I've seen it, multiple times, and I think I've seen it one time. I think I saw it in the theater one time when I saw the PG-13. And then, I saw it on, DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, and I've seen it 5 or 6 times, right? So, every time I see it, I see the unrated cut. And yet, whenever I think about that movie, the thing that jumps out of my mind is, the the part at the end where John McClane kills Timothy Olyphant, mm-hmm. and he does the yippee-ki-yay motherfucker, but the motherfucker is covered up with the gunshot. Mm-hmm. And that was just so cheap and so tacky and so boring and so uninspired that it just kind of, you know, sullied the movie. And I know that, you know, I'm fighting about the integrity of keeping the word motherfucker in a movie, but you know, if they're going to cover it up with a gunshot, they should have done something else. And you know, I like this movie a lot, but I think that you have three diehard movies that have been R-rated, that have been successful, that mm-hmm. you know, these aren't movies that, you know, that you take grandma to, or that you expect to really shape your kids into good people. But it, to me, it just seemed like, you know, messing with success, and it just seemed like dumb studio interaction. And I'm sure you've heard on Smodcast and blah 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 all the behind the scenes stuff that, you know, went on with that movie, and the fighting for the PG-13 and the integrity of the McClane character. And you know, it just seemed like a movie with a lot of studio interference, and Bruce Willis interference as well. But it's just that, it's just they were messing with success, and I don't see the point.
Well, and I think that it even played out as the most commercial of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because, you know, you had the huge gap. You had the, you know, because like Yippee-ki-yay motherfucker. Okay, I'm one of those people. I've gotten to a point in my life, I don't mind cussing, but I want it to be clever and I want it to be well placed. And Yippee-ki-yay motherfucker was literally like one of the best uses, you know, of motherfucker that I've heard in probably 20 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it became such an iconic catchphrase. But for, you know, for me, that movie was made to make money. And, you know, when you go through the whole industry debate about, you know, PG-13, and just by rating a movie R, how much of the your audience you lose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I agree with what they did, because Die Hard is, you know, messing with Die Hard is no es bueno. But I think that you know, because the action, I mean, the budget, you want to talk about, you know, millions and millions of dollars of stuff getting torn up. I mean, that movie was full of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that the whole point of that movie, especially after that long of a hiatus, was it was designed to be a commercial success, and they did do a lot of things to upset the diehard fans, mm-hmm. pun intended.
I don't know. You know, to me, it's not a bad movie, but to me, like, you know, to, you know, stick it in that PG-13 mold, just, you know, it felt kind of false and it felt kind of disingenuous, you know, because, you know, we aren't going to see this movie because, you know, I'm 13 years old and that's what's open at the theater. I'm going to see it because, you know, I liked the first three, and, you know, and I wouldn't call myself a diehard fan. I mean, like, I liked them to varying degrees, but I don't know, just something about that. About that marketing just seemed kind of, you know, yucky to me. Best way I can put it.
No, I agree with you.
As I understand it, it was a sort of a studio imposed thing, as far as, you know, it's been 12 years since the last one, and we want to maximize the whole appeal type of thing. And
yep,
you know, and it's 20th Century Fox, and they're notorious for doing things like that. Just look at the Alien versus Predators, you know, movie. They insisted on it being PG-13. But you have Live Free or Die Hard, I still think is very, at its core, still a Die Hard movie, because it still feels like a Die Hard movie. And I think that's a very important thing.
Yes.
And, yeah, I mean, all of the...
I like the Justin Long character, too, by the way.
Yes. He's almost, you know, I was worried he was going to be a bit too obnoxious, but actually he was really the comic relief, and sort of acted as this, the sort of voice of the audience, I think, at times.
Okay. Yeah. I like how you put that.
Cause you're watching it and, you know, you see John McClane destroy a helicopter using a car. And then Justin Long says, "You just used a car to destroy a helicopter."
Yeah.
Kind of yeah. a Captain Obvious, but in a very lovable sort of way.
But he's like he ends up being the guy who says what the audience is thinking at the time, going, "Really? Okay.
You just kill a car with a helicopter, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, overall it's an enjoyable movie, and you know, I can have it on, you know, the unrated cut, and it's, you know, much better. But yeah, it's all right.
It's a good one. It's a good one. And, you know, this one had, I don't think, broke any kind of records. It didn't outshine, I think, the first one. I think the first one is you know, one of those perfect gems of film.
Oh, sure.
But this one, I think, was a deserved addition to the franchise. And that brings us to the most recent one.
Yes, it does.
2013, A Good Day to Die Hard. Whose, you know, wonderful tagline is Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Russia. The movie,
which started as an internet meme.
Yes.
Did you know that?
That
blows my. I don't even know what to make of that, because somebody was making fun of the movie when it came out that it was going to be in Russia, and some asshole on the internet, you know, just took up a picture of John McClane and was making fun of it, and said, you know, Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Russia. And 20th Century Fox is all like, hey, that's cool, let's use that.
Yeah.
It's like, so they're making fun of you, and you're embracing it like it's serious. You know, it reminds me of when Reagan used the Born in the USA thing with Bruce Springsteen, and just not getting it.
Yeah, well, hearing that it was a meme, just made me throw up in my mouth a little bit and swallow it. Yeah. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Now I just saw this movie last night.
Okay, let's talk about this one.
Like I sort of said to you, I've seen worse action movies, but I've seen four better Die Hard movies. When it comes to Good Day to Die Hard, this is the shortest Die Hard movie. I think it comes in at like 98 minutes or something like that. Which is exactly how long it needed to be. But my sort of problem with this movie was it didn't feel like a Die Hard movie. And we already sort of touched on the villain whole aspect, but there's no, you know, in the first movie you've got Alan Rickman. In the second movie it's William Sadler. Third movie, Jeremy Irons. Fourth movie is Timothy Oliphant. This movie, some dude.
Some guy.
Just some guy.
Yeah.
And it's kind of disappointing, because really, at no point did I feel, at no point in the movie was I like, well, you know, I want to see more about the villain. Because in all of the movies, in all the previous movies, you know, you find yourself not, or really in action movies in general that aren't this, you know, mundane action movies. A lot of times you're sitting there and you're really just waiting for the good guy to show up. You're just waiting for that to happen so things can explode and cool stuff can happen. But in the Die Hard movies, you don't care, because when the villain is on screen, you're still like, this is really cool. I really like this guy. I want to see more of this guy. And that happens in all of them, but that doesn't happen in A Good Day to Die Hard. Because you just find yourself waiting for John McClane to show up and do stuff.
Sort of.
And it's just was so disappointing. It's very much, you know how you have a sequel out there that's very much a, well, we got to rush this one out because we want to capitalize on the success of the last one and have so people remember this. And we had his daughter in that one, so we'll put his son in this one, and let's put it in Russia. It felt very contrived. And you know, not only to say is you have four previous movies where this character, John McClane, has found himself in these insane situations out of happenstance. And you could say, well, that's kind of unrealistic type of thing. In this one, it just is kind of, this is sort of the camel that breaks the straw's back, you know? You just are like, I really just don't feel it. And definitely, a lackluster addition to the Die Hard franchise. But I guess every series, every franchise has to do it, has to have something in there. But, you know, until this one came out, Die Hard 2 was probably my least favorite, but I still really liked it. This one is now my least favorite, but I think it's okay. And, of course, you know, it's they go to Russia, and if they go to Russia, of course, the villain's plot has to involve Chernobyl, because what else is in Russia besides Moscow and Chernobyl? It's just...
Vodka.
Yeah, it's just... Yeah, and vodka. Very thin, very, very... very thin movie. It's not a... I just think it's a bad addition to the franchise, and was expecting some more, you know, insane giggling. But that all being said, you know, it has its moments. It has bits and pieces here and there, but I think overall, just you know, if this is the last time we see John McClane, that'll be disappointing, but it'll also be okay. If this is the best you can do, you can stop now, you know.
Well, and do you think that this is kind of a result of kind of current movie culture, you know, as far as the style and the, you know, the way that it was made? Or you think it's just you know, too much of a good thing, you know, or the wrong execution of the right idea? I mean, what's kind of your take on it? Because, you know, you guys are both hardcore movie fans. You know, what do you guys think?
I think the fact that they're releasing it in, they planned on releasing it automatically in February, which is not a ripe time for big action movies or something that, I mean, you know, frankly, it's Die Hard. You know, there's no reason that a good Die Hard movie can't compete in the summer blockbuster time frame. But the fact that the studio decided where we're going to put it in February, when there's not as much competition, tells me that they didn't have they knew what they were doing. They knew that they had a movie that wasn't going to really measure up to these other franchises and these other movies that were coming out, especially during the summer of this coming summer. And it just sort of felt like, you know, how Bruce Willis, you know, like him or hate him, occasionally he does something that's really good. I mean, last year Looper mm-hmm. was fantastic. I loved Looper. But then he does movies for paychecks. This is one of those movies.
This was a payday.
This was a, hey, we want to do another Die Hard. Here's a dump truck of money. And that's pretty much how it felt like. He's like, yeah, by the way, I'm John McClane in this movie. But really, I'm just being Bruce Willis.
Yep.
But this movie was directed by the guy who did Max Payne, which...
John Moore or whatever.
John Moore, yeah, which is also one of an absolutely terrible action movie. So this is, you know, as far as, you know, sort of the way action movies are going, I think I for one have been sorely unimpressed with how action movies have been going, because a lot of them have just been taking themselves too seriously. And this, whereas especially in the last one, in Live Free or Die Hard, they really recognized that it was there was a level of absurdity, that, you know, it was a little tongue-in-cheek, and that they at least gave you a little bit of a wink there. But in this one, there's no such thing. They feel like they're doing this very serious action film, and it's just, that doesn't work.
So, like it or not, like The Expendables.
Mm-hmm.
And The Expendables 2, you know, obviously, you know, as serious as it was supposed to be, there was a lot of, we fully realize, you know.
I like the Expendables movies. They understand what they're making. They understand that they're making a cheeseball action movie. And that,
right, a star-studded, craptastic, spectacular.
That this is not Shakespeare, and they're doing what they're doing, but they have this self-awareness to it. But this movie did not have that.
Okay, so it was almost like, in The Expendables, you kind of break the fourth wall, as mm-hmm. they like to say in theater. Whereas with this, it was all they seemed to be on serious mode the whole time.
Yes, exactly.
Autopilot.
There are some forced parts of levity in this movie. I don't know if you caught that, Aaron. But there are times when they try to sort of lighten the mood, but it's just poorly executed.
Yeah. I don't think that was it a good day to die. I don't think this movie deserves the analytics that we're giving it.
Sure.
To me, I just think it was, you know, plain and simply, I just think it was a bad movie. There's one thing that was fun about the previous four Die Hard movies. It was the escalation. It was the, you know, the great villains. It was, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, this movie doesn't really up the ante at all, because instead, you know, I mean, it's kind of almost a step backwards, because, you know, you had, you know, building, you had skyscraper, airport, city, country, and then your next thought is the world, but instead they just move it to another country, mm-hmm. but it's just a small area of the country, and, you know, you have that going on, and then again, you cast a nobody, and I have nothing against the guy, but, you know, I think that you need some name recognition for your villain, and they didn't do that. I thought that the
action needs to be a villain that feels like he can, you know, feels like a villain, you know?
Yeah, not just that. And, like, the action beats in this movie were just, you know, goofy. Mm-hmm. When he was driving on top of the other cars, and, you know, and I was thinking about it, and I think that you could take this movie, the screenplay for this movie, and give it to a, you know, wet behind the ears, fresh out of film school, you know, screenplay writer, and a sloppy, lazy rewrite could remove John McClane entirely, mm-hmm. and it wouldn't even be a Die Hard movie. You know, to me, this almost felt like a B movie, you know, like a B direct-to-video movie that somebody added John McClane into, and very clumsily at that. And it was just, it's just not a good movie. I mean, Ethan said it was okay, and I don't even think it was okay. I didn't like it at all. I saw this on Saturday, and I don't really remember anything about it much. The only thing that really popped out of my mind was, like, when the bad guy died, they did the throwback to the first Die Hard, which I didn't think he deserved, you know, because it wasn't like this was somebody cool, or this was somebody with any connection to Hans Gruber. And, you know, it just not a good movie. I mean, it was pretty much just a bad movie, and it was unfortunate. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, for me, I want to see the proposed sixth one in space, No One Can Hear You Die Hard, where he's on a space shuttle. I mean, that's the one I want to see. Just take it up into Jason X level of ridiculousness.
John McClane is cryogenically frozen.
Yeah. And have him meet Sigourney Weaver.
Yes.
Might as well.
Well, you know, and for me, the highlight, I mean, to me, there were some okay action scenes, nothing, you know, I mean, but to me, kind of one of the big highlights, because I was in the military, was kind of seeing some of, like, the Soviet armored personnel carriers and the Russian stuff like that. And when I'm in an action movie and I'm more excited about seeing, you know, Soviet BTRs, then, you know, there's something wrong there.
Yeah. Like, hey, that's a cool chopper. Oh, yeah, there's Bruce Willis. But that's a cool chopper.
Yeah.
I kind of like the slow motion jumping out the building scene when Bruce Willis was getting the finger, but, you know, that hardly saves it for me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and again, that's still kind of a throwback in a way to,
it is.
You know, only the last time he was tied to a fire hose.
Yeah.
Wasn't impressed. Not going to buy it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that also makes it hard is, because we have so much love and appreciation for the other movies, that I think that's one of the reasons we're kind of analyzing this one so much. Because, you know, it's like that aunt that always gives you that really cool Christmas present, and then one year she doesn't produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's...
It's too bad.
It's doing bad. Well, so we'll probably get another a Die Hard, you know, 6, I suppose. I don't know where they can really go from here. The going sort of
space
joke is obviously
I'm telling you, he's on a commercial
Oh, he's on the Virgin the Virgin spaceflight thing.
What do you guys think about them trying to bring his son? I mean, I'm not saying I want him to do it, but you know, because Bruce Willis is getting up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think Jai Courtney is going to be selling any tickets soon. To tell you the truth,
I could never see that character again, and I'd be okay with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually more disappointed that there wasn't at least a Justin Long cameo.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I get it that he wasn't in it, but I would have liked, you know, I don't know, just like some little scene where they're trying to hack through a mainframe and he gives them a call up and it gives them a call. Just something like that. And, you know, I could have cared less about the Jai Courtney character. It was just boring. I just didn't like it.
It was very much an attempt to do sort of an American James Bond thing, and it just didn't work. As far as using his son in future things, I don't watch Die Hard to see John's kids run around. I watch it to see John McClane do his thing. But if they stopped with this one, I mean, we've got four solid movies done, you know, and nothing's gonna get rid of those, to be honest. And,
right, but people are so fickle these days, you know, you kind of just go, I almost want you to make another movie just so it doesn't end on that note.
Yeah. Well, and the studio is, you know, 20th Century Fox or any studio is very prone to beat a dead horse. And so if this one does well, they'll want to do another one. Now this sort of brings us to sort of wrapping things up, but the what is it about the Die Hard franchise that, I mean, Die Hard, as I said at the beginning, Die Hard pretty much created its own genre or subgenre of movies. You know, it's like, oh, we now have things where we compare it to Die Hard, or we say it's Die Hard, it's this but with Die Hard mixed in. How do you think that that's affected movies since 1988, since this came out? You know, I mean, can you imagine the action movie, you know, industry without Die Hard?
I don't know that it would be that different. I mean, yeah, sure, there'd be some things that were different. I mean, this isn't, you know, I mean, it definitely has had its influence, but we're not talking Citizen Kane or Star Wars or Gone with the Wind or Wizard of Oz or something like that. I mean, you know, there's maybe some, you know, action beats that, you know, got to a little bit quicker because some of the things they did in it, you know, like the whole Euro trash thing, the international villain was something that was going to come, whether it came from Die Hard or something like that. You know, me, I like the Die Hard movies to varying degrees. Like, I like the first one, I like the third one, and you know, whatever, but you know, I'm not particularly fond of it. So I like them, but you know, they're not that important to me. You know, I don't consider them, you know, big in my, you know, my cinematic education or anything like that. But you know, they are what they are, and I like them. And you know, one of my favorite Die Hard things that's come out in years was the Cleveland Show parody Die Semi Hard. It came out, I think it was last year, you know, in the vein of the Family Guy Star Wars, and it was just a normal episode, and you know, obviously Cleveland was John McClane, and Tim the Bear was Hans Gruber, and you know, just fun little stuff like that, and I like watching that, but you know, that does show that it has had its impact on, you know, pop culture, and you know, I'm glad it's out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, for me, I think the really telling thing about the Die Hard franchise is have you guys noticed? I noticed on Facebook this year in particular, everybody saying we're watching our family Christmas movie, Die Hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been seeing that for years.
Yeah, well, I mean, but this year it really jumped out at me. And to me, when you have a rated R action movie that is your family Christmas movie, that says something about it.
My wife thinks I'm she looks at me like I'm crazy and sort of pats me on the head. And I'm like, I'm going to watch my Christmas movie. And my Christmas movie is And She'll Always Be Die Hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, and John McClane literally is like the king of the island of misfit toys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's who he is. But, and, you know, things, you know, and when you start to distill it for, say, pop culture, you know, Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. You know, even the Roy Rogers, you know, references, especially, and I am kind of focusing on the first one, but to me, I think that the statement about the influence that it's had cinematically, I agree with you, Aaron. I don't think that it has had the cinematic impact that a lot of other movies had, but I think if you shift that over to pop culture, I think that it has had a significant impact, you know, on pop culture. And so for that, I think that it kind of, in my book, gets a little more elevation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, obviously people do love those movies, and, you know, it's had its influence on pop culture. But, you know, I think a lot of people like to think of the Die Hard movies as the, you know, air quotes in the air, bad action movie that they liked from the 80s, and they package it like that. But, you know, it isn't a bad action movie. It still holds up to this day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I would say easily the first Die Hard rates higher than a lot of action movies I've seen, especially recently. I mean, the newest Die Hard is the third brand new movie I've seen this year, and it's the best movie I've seen this year. That tells you...
Oof, really?
Yeah, that tells you how things have measured up so far. And I've seen, and the other two I've seen have been Last Stand with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bullet to the Head with Sylvester Stallone. Both terrible movies. Just bad. And it you know, if a movie the caliber like the very first Die Hard were to come out right now, I would be over freaking joyed that we got something that absolutely fantastic, you know, and with great characters, great set pieces, great action, and that actually made sense, you know.
I really think that
because I'm a huge Dirty Harry fan, and I think Die Hard sort of shows up at the right time, which is sort of passing the torch of that sort of rogue cop that Dirty Harry was into this new type of rogue cop that is John McClane. And now we have this. And I think, I for one, don't think they should do any more. I think it's just end it and be done with it. But I know that they won't do that because they're going to keep making money with it. We're, like I said, we're always going to have those first four movies that we do like, you know, we're, even if you don't like, you know, number three or number four or number two, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you like the first one, you're always going to be able to go back and watch that first one. You're always going to be able to enjoy watching a young Bruce Willis with hair getting all dirtied up and bloodied up. And of course, see Alan Rickman, you know, a very young Severus Snape. In an Armani suit, threatening to kill a bunch of hostages and steal $600 million in negotiable bearer bonds. So,
yes. Guys, I think I figured out the next Die Hard movie. I think they need to do a buddy film with John McClane and Judge Dredd.
Ooh, hey, I'd watch that.
There you go. There you go.
I would watch that. Honestly, I think they should just recut and re-release The Fifth Element.
Oh, great movie.
And instead of calling him Corbin Dallas, call him John McClane, and that would be Die Hard 6.
You know what? I would pay a lot of money to see that.
Maybe add in a few extra scenes here and there, but I think, honestly, you could just leave it as is, and it would be adequate, because then he saves the universe. And really, where do you go from that? I mean, the universe to multiverse?
There you go.
You know, I mean... Not very far, you know. At some point, it's going to get kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But, well, and I think Russia was the place where it got ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
And nobody threw any cars at planes or helicopters in this one.
But I think that's a good talk of Die Hard. We all die-hearted. Let's do a quick sort of round the table here. Aaron, which one is your personal favorite?
You know, I'd like to see a mashup where they make, you know, Die Hard with a Vengeance, but, you know, maybe, you know, Hans Gruber can come back to the ghost or something, because, you know, I loved Hans Gruber in the first one, but I probably enjoy watching the first one better, or I'm sorry, the third one better. I do really like that movie.
Nice. Cape, what's your personal favorite?
It's gotta be one.
Number one's a good one. Number one's a good one.
Where are you at, Ethan?
Well, if I had to sit down and choose, you know, I'm a classics guy, so I would have to say the first one is a great movie. I also really like that the fourth one is just a lot of fun. It's a cheese ball, balls to the wall, cheese-tastic movie.
Racist melon farmer.
Well, with that, I think we're good to go. We'll see if we can get Kate back on, as he just dropped again. But
okay,
so we can all say our goodbyes.
Alrighty.
Skype doing its wonderful thing today.
Indeed.
It's getting ready for snowpocalypse.
Snowpocalypse. Man, I want another sandwich. That was good.
Roast beast.
Good shit. What should we do next week?
Yeah, there we go. We could continue on, what were we on, like the 60s?
Yeah.
We could continue into the 60s if you want. Yeah,
I think okay, we can do that. We can do that. I think we pretty good decade.
We could even eventually do stuff like, you know, favorite actor of 2000s, actors, you know, actors and favorite directors, you know.
Okay, we've done favorite directors twice.
Yeah,
but not by decade.
But yeah, I'm talking by decade. We can milk this decade thing for a while now.
Oh yeah, we totally could. Totally could.
Best set designer.
Yeah.
Best grip. Best boy.
Best second.
Yes. Best second unit director. Best script doctor. Best intern.
Best rotoscopist. Is it snowing yet?
I don't know. I can't see outside from here. I would like to get him back on to say goodbye, but
yeah.
Hooray for Skype.
Yeah, we can complain about Skype all we want, but it's the best answer. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, sorry about that, gentlemen.
It's all right. It's the interwebs.
Okay.
We're just wrap things up, so.
Okay. I wanted to tell you guys, are you wrapping up, like, done?
Yes, we will be, we're going to say our goodbyes and you know.
Oh, okay.
But what was up?
Oh, I wanted to tell you guys before we do quick. Much I appreciate me and as you're doing any kind of movies you think I could give you some input on, I'd love to join you.
Cool.
Yeah,
all right, sounds good.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, if you need a server, let me know. But anyway, so I'm ready for wrap ups or whatever.
Alrighty. Well, I think that about wraps up talking about the seminal Die Hard franchise. I want to say thank you to Cape Rust for joining us on this fine episode.
It was an honor.
We had a great time. And in the meantime, you know, the Oscars are coming up this coming Sunday. I'm not sure when this episode's going to be going out. Might be before, might be after, probably after, what with Aaron's computer issues that he's having. Regardless, when this goes up, you might be able to actually jump in on voting for the Pop Culture Movie Showdown that we're going to be, that the second annual should be going on. Starting up, I plan to have that up and running starting, I hope, next week. So, we'll see, yes. For those not in the know, the Pop Culture Movie Showdown is a random drawing of movie characters that are not associated with other media like comic books or, you know, or anything like that, comic books or novels or anything, that will face each other in either battle of wits, fisticuffs, or gun battles, or however you want to characterize it in your mind. And then when it all comes down to it at the end, you have one champion remaining. And last year's champion, of course, was Bruce Campbell, the of course Ash from the Evil Dead series, who eked it out over Indiana Jones. So that was a lot of fun. But we'll have that going on, hopefully starting in the next week or two, with some random mashups. I'm gonna add some more names to the list this year. I believe I've come up with a few more that we can add on. So that's about it, really. Other than that, either watch the Oscars this weekend, or I hope you enjoyed watching the Oscars. So. Unless you guys have anything else you want to add?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. Lights are turned down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in the storm. But if you'll really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. As long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Doesn't care if it's 10 below. You're sitting by the fire's cozy glow. He don't care about the cold and the winds that blow. He just says, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Let it snow.
Ooh-wee, goes the star. Why should he worry when he's nice and warm?
By his side and the lights turn low. He just says, let it snow, let it snow. The weather outside is frightful, but that fire is delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought lots of corn for popping. The lights are way down low, so let it snow, let it snow, let it snow,
let it snow.
When we finally say goodnight, how I'll hate going out in the storm. But if you'll only hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, dear, we're still goodbye. Long as you love me so, let it snow.